Hello, and welcome to Ride the Omnibus. I'm your host, Ariel Baska, and today we're taking time to reflect on the legacies of two women who died this past month, both of them feminist icons in their own ways, who died a week apart. One was known for sporting a tight black catsuit and a badass attitude, and the other was known for her loose black judge's robes and sharp acumen. I am talking, of course, about Dame Diana Rigg and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG. And here to talk about these incredible women with me is another incredible woman, the amazing Zoya Fansler. Welcome to the show, Zoya. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Ariel. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, I'm so delighted that you could be on to discuss this because you're one of my few friends who is so both joyously political in your orientation to the world and unapologetically feminist in your orientation as well. And I think that makes for a wonderful discussion about these two powerful women.
Well, thank you. That is so kind of you. And as the feminist slogan goes, the personal is political. I see it as all interconnected.
It is. It absolutely is. And one thing that I think I'm going to sort of bring up right away is that both of these women have sort of different relationships to the feminist movement. Diana Rigg, even though she was viewed particularly based on her role on the Avengers as a proto-feminist icon, she herself was very vocal about never wanting to be called a feminist and how virulently she fought against ever having that term applied to her. What do you believe that is a part of in her life?
Do you know, I think sometimes feminism gets a bad name. I don't know whether it was during second wave of feminism and anti-ERA kind of efforts and an association with feminism with bra burners and people who would undermine family values. But I think really feminism is about choice. It's about honoring any choice that a woman could make, whether she wants to have a career, wants to, you know, have children and be married, wants to stay single. It's really about having every opportunity that a man would have. It's about equality.
Yeah. And Diana Rigg herself actually fought for equality quite a bit. She was actually called a mercenary for kicking up a fuss that not only were her male co-stars better paid than her, so were the cameramen. She even said if women were paid equal to men, they'd get equal respect. A rich woman is listened to, a poor woman is not.
And it's so ironic that some women and some people who fight so hard for equality resist that feminist label. And I think Diana Rigg falls into that category. She really did some admirable things with respect to equal pay. But, you know, I guess we honor it if she doesn't want to keep that feminist label, even though I would consider her a feminist for that. I want to look up my favorite definition of feminism.
Sure.
And I know that you're familiar with it. So here's my favorite definition of feminism from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I may be pronouncing that name wrong. A feminist is a person who believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes. It's so concise. It's so beautiful. And I really think that you can see that principle in the cases that Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued in front of the Supreme Court before she became a justice herself.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very clear part of her identity in terms of what she strove for on a legal basis. And it's maybe the clearest articulation I've heard of exactly what her arguments were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's ever been simplified down to that particular nugget about feminism for me before, but I love that. That's a wonderful quote. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
And, you know, and it doesn't seem particularly controversial to me to hear that expressed, nor does it seem like it would be controversial to Diana Rigg either. Mm-hmm. Both she and RBG are from the same generation. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was born on March 15th, 1933, and Diana Rigg was born July 20th, 1938. So they were only 5 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
And they also both fought for equality in different ways. Obviously, Diana Rigg did it primarily on sets in Western media, primarily, whereas Ruth Bader Ginsburg was doing so in the legal code. And I just wonder, when we remember both of these women and their impact, what's strange to me is that the more people I talk to since both of their deaths, the more I hear about media representations of both of them. So in the case of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, even though she was a historical figure and there are so many dossiers of information about her that you can access, at the same time, most everybody who knows something about her knows it from the documentary RBG or from the movie On the Basis of Sex.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Diana Rigg, I think she had a big influence, largely just because she was in media and in culture and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of funny how the pop culture influence of both of these women has been so pronounced.
Oh, yeah. I mean, RBG was just such a rock star towards the end of her life.
Yeah.
The notorious RGB and the following that she gained from all those memes was something else. I wanted to back up and ask you what you think about the idea that a person might be a feminist in how they play a role, or probably it's easier to make the argument, or in the kinds of roles, acting roles, that they might take. Because, you know, part of the reason why I admire Diana Rigg so much is the way that she portrayed these various characters. There was always a strength to her portrayal in the things that I particularly loved her in, you know, like the Avengers and Game of Thrones. And the other thing that I really loved about her acting was, you know, it always came across how smart she was. You know, you could see her thinking and you could see her being a really, you know, logical, strong person.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I don't think that that's always the case. I mean, especially in that Avengers role, it might have been so easy to just be a sex pot, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting about Diana Rigg is that she actually started her career on the stage. She was with the RSC before her stint on the Avengers. She mm-hmm. actually deliberately sought out the part on the Avengers and went after it. And none of her, you know, colleagues at the RSC understood why she was doing that, or, you know, I mean, they mostly derided her for the choice to mm-hmm. do something that was so, you know, demeaning, they felt, to right. her intelligence. But what I think was really incredible about that particular choice for her, when she goes to the Avengers, her character is Emma Peel. Even the name is a play on the term man appeal. Mm-hmm. She's this beautiful, intellectual, confident woman. She's enormously appealing. She drives around in her little Lotus Elan saying things like, apart from me, you're the best driver I know. She says that in the very first episode, which is almost sort of unheard of on British television at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what's incredible to me is that she deliberately chose to go into pop culture and into the realm of pop culture so that she could make a difference. And this isn't something that she talks about quite so explicitly elsewhere, but it's hinted at in some of her interviews that she felt that she wasn't going to get very far in terms of what she wanted to do with her projects and be able to control what kinds of projects she got, mm-hmm. unless she did something that was a breakout popular hit.
Interesting. I mean, there might have been a financial aspect to it also.
Oh, I'm sure there was.
Yeah. I imagine that it would have been, you know, she would have been much, much better paid as a television actress or a movie actress than as an actress on the stage. But all the same, you know, she had a huge impact. I mean, but before you and I started talking, I was thinking about, you know, what I wanted to say about Diana Rigg, and I wrote a note to myself. I was like, I need to look up some synonyms for beautiful and cool and poised and sophisticated, because, you know, that was what she was in The Avengers. That was what she was in Game of Thrones. I think you're much more familiar with her entire body of work, so you might be able to talk more to some of the other kinds of roles that she did. But that's the overall impression that I have of her work, having seen those two endpoints.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, what she did after The Avengers, though, I mean, she tried to break into American markets with a American TV show called Diana that kind of failed to go anywhere, unfortunately. But her work, as it continued in the 70s, she was doing some incredible things that, to me, demonstrate a very feminist mindset. That she was only taking roles where she was clearly either the intellectual equal or superior of everyone around her.
Well, there you go. I mean, that goes to my point of, can you be a feminist and what roles you select?
Seriously. And like, if you look at On Her Majesty's Secret Service, I mean, yeah, it's George Lazenby, but she's the only wife of James Bond. She's the only woman who's treated as James Bond's equal.
Yeah,
in those series of films. And I don't think that's an accident.
I read that George Lazenby specifically asked for Diana Rigg in that role. And he did it because he hadn't ever done film acting before. And he wanted someone to support him in that. He wanted someone to show him the ropes. And he knew that she would be the right person for that.
Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't on set, but I can assume that, you know, she did so with great aplomb.
Yes. I think she held him in some affection. I mean, according to that one interview that I read about her one James Bond film.
Well, and additionally, like, she goes on to do a number of other films, like Theater of Blood, which is a charming horror film with Vincent Price, where A Little Night Music is Charlotte, who actually has this wonderful song called Every Day a Little Death about all the indignities you have to suffer as a woman in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a musical by Sondheim, and that particular song, if you want to hear more about my thoughts on feminism in that song, you can listen to the Little Night Music podcast, but...
Sounds good.
I really think she was very deliberate about taking these kinds of roles that allowed her to showcase both her ability, but also ways in which women were portrayed in different societies, different eras, and how little has changed for women.
Mm-hmm.
In the centuries. I also remember her Hedda Gabler being just incredible. It's based on an Ibsen play. Ibsen is mostly known now for having written A Doll's House, which is the play where famously Nora leaves her husband at the end of the play and walks out on her family to go live an independent life. And so Ibsen is that kind of author who was a bit of an iconoclast for his time, who really felt that women should have their own narratives. Mm-hmm. And Hedda Gabler is another one of these plays, but in this one, Hedda is both extremely intellectual and trapped and unsure what to do with herself. And Diana Rigg plays this role in such a nuanced way. If you can get your hands on the 1981 version of it, I highly recommend you check it out.
I will definitely check it out.
Yeah. And, oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I just was going to also interject that I recall seeing Diana Rigg also in the 1968 version of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh.
Yes, which was another fantastic performance, but pretty close to, you know, the era when she did The Avengers. So she was her usual stunning, beautiful self, intelligent self.
Who did she play?
She played Helena.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
That's
but still strong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just very interesting to think of her in that particular role, just because most of my knowledge of Diana Rigg comes from her later life. I happened to be living in England in 1993 when she was playing Medea, and I fell in love with her and with Euripides and with Greek tragedy all sort of at once in 1993 when I saw her as Medea.
Wow.
She was so powerful. The production of Medea, spoilers for anyone who's not seen this thousands-year-old play, but you know what? It's thousands of years old. I'm given the spoiler anyway. She's spurned by Jason after helping him to get the Golden Fleece, and he decides to leave her for a Greek princess, so Medea decides to kill their two sons. And after the murder of their two sons, she kills Jason's bride-to-be and her father. And then she rides off in her dragon chariot and wreaks some havoc elsewhere. But what's really cool about this production was that Diana Rigg literally brings down the house. She had the most powerhouse performance vocally. I read later that she actually tore her vocal cords regularly in this performance, and so she wasn't allowed to talk during the day, so she would just go to the museums during the day and wander around and enjoy looking at the art. And
wow, you know,
that was sort of her routine.
That's incredible.
She won the Olivier for it in London. She won the Tony for it in New York. It is one of those performances that I will remember for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And to see that in contrast with Avengers being on TV at the same time was like, what? I don't get this. I don't get this.
I am quite envious that you saw her on stage in that production. That must have been just fantastic.
It was. And I mean, you know, who's to say? Maybe it was part of why I became a Latin teacher. Who knows? And became obsessed with Greek theater. Maybe that was it too. But
that could have been a formative influence. Yes, indeed.
Well, it definitely was a formative influence. But then you have her around the same time getting roles like Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca on television, because it seems like most of the roles that are what she really wanted to be and what she wanted to embody for people seem to not really be there as much in the 90s. However, she was following in Dame Judith Anderson's footsteps with that role. And so I think that was why she was eager to take that one. But then her is Lady Olenna. in Game of Thrones. Like, there is nothing better, in my opinion.
I think she stole the show. Those episodes where, again, spoiler alert, where she's confessing to one of the biggest murders, really one of the murders that viewers had been waiting and waiting for. And she's not sorry at all. It's great.
It is great. And what I also love about it is that she actually made the character choice to wear a wimple for Game of Thrones because she didn't want to spend excessive amounts of time in hair and makeup. Nobody's got time for that. So Diana is going to just wear a wimple and focus on the performance.
You know, I loved that. And I thought it added a different flavor to the show. You know, there was so much of the story that came from English history and various royal history that I thought it fit right in, you know?
It did.
Each house had its own look. And even though, you know, she apparently insisted on that, I loved that fashion choice.
I did too. And it worked so well.
So I just want to ask you about a couple of other things that I notice on Diana Riggs' IMDb page. And the first one is the easiest. I did not know that she appeared in a TV movie named after me because I came first, you know, 1995 TV movie called Zoya, based on the Danielle Steele book. I was named after a Solzhenitsyn novel, not any Danielle Steele novel. So not that there's anything wrong with Danielle Steele novels. I'm not putting that down. Anyway, she had a role in that movie. So that's like a very cool connection. I don't know whether you ever saw that. Must have been masterpiece. No, you did not see that masterpiece.
No, sorry.
All right. But the other thing that I noticed that she was in, and this was in an era where I don't know, there's a good chance that I might have seen it. It was the 1985 TV miniseries Bleak House on Masterpiece
Theater. Oh, yes,
Theater.
Yes. I own that, actually.
Really? Okay.
I do.
So she plays Lady Honoria Dedlock?
Yes.
Yeah.
Lady Dedlock.
Wow. So she was fabulous in that, I'm sure.
Oh, she was. She was quite forbidding, as they say. I mean, in that Dickensian way, you have to be.
Right.
That production of Bleak House was particularly bleak, as I recall.
Oh, dear.
I mean, not that any production of Bleak House isn't, but, you know, not around that time. But later, I actually also saw her in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as Martha. And she did an incredible job in that role, too.
Well,
where she's
great.
Deconstructing the feminine, basically.
Yeah. Well, there again, I want to bring that back to my question, which I don't think I really have a perfect answer to, right? About, you know, what kind of roles would a feminist take? And it sounds like Diana Rigg was not afraid to take an unsympathetic role. I mean, Medea certainly is not, she didn't play that as a sympathetic character, I'm imagining, or not completely
well,
sympathetic.
Well, she is actually a sympathetic character.
Okay.
That's actually one of the things that I love about that play by Euripides, is that it's entirely from Medea's perspective.
Okay.
And you see the betrayal and the anger and the lack of agency that she has, that she is entirely ruled, that her life is entirely ruled by men. First her father, then her brother, then Jason, who she loved dearly and committed atrocities for, including against her own brother. And then he would turn on her this way. And just the anger that she has.
Well, it sounds like a feminist role, that does. And then getting back to, I retract that as an example for my point about choosing sympathetic versus unsympathetic characters to play. But it sounds like playing a Dickensian villain falls under the category of an unsympathetic character. So she wasn't afraid to take that on.
No, she wasn't.
And I think that, you know, I think that a feminist is someone who believes in the full range of humanity in every gender. You know, it's someone who says, just because someone is born a woman does not mean that they're going to be somehow more moral, more saintly,
exactly,
more nurturing, more maternal than the opposite gender. And, you know, also, you know, a feminist would believe that women are just as likely to be capable of atrocious behavior as men are. So I think that a Dickensian villain might be somewhere on that spectrum.
Well, Medea is still on that spectrum for sure. But so is also Theater of Blood. I would even say Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca is certainly on that spectrum as well. So she's no stranger to villainy in her roles. And I would say, you know, the whole idea of being an equal opportunity, you know, killer is definitely within her range.
Yeah. So,
and
great stuff.
And probably deliberate too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, she's fascinating to watch. Everything that I see her in, she's fascinating.
And I keep coming back to this quote from Eliza Doolittle. One of the roles that she played on stage was Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. And the character says, the difference between a lady and a flower girl is not how she behaves, but how she is treated. And, you know, there was an article in The New Yorker all about how she was demanding parity in terms of her pay with co-stars and parity on behalf of other females in the industry. And even though she never actually achieved it, the fight for it comes back to that quote for me. And that, you know, the way in which we are treated as women and the way in which we are given that equality is the thing that is the most important. Because I feel like she had to work around a lot of things in her life. Like she had to take certain, like taking the role in the Avengers, to take that cute kittenish role was sort of necessary. I mean, Emma Peel is still thought of as this proto-feminist role, but additionally, it was a wise career move. She felt that she had to fight against the label of feminism. She felt that she had to create this cute persona in all of her interviews where she was hilarious and made her male interviewers as charmed as could possibly be.
Sounds very Jennifer Lawrence-ish, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah.
Or Julia Roberts or some of the other people who are, some of the other women who are great interviews. I'm doing air quotes there.
And it's funny, you know, you think about this in contrast to that quote. And, you know, it makes you just kind of wonder about the world in which she lived and the context in which she had to fight for that feminine space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there definitely was an evolution in terms of the roles that would have been available to 1960s actress versus, you know, an actress in the 2000s and 2010s. Big difference, big evolution. And yeah, and I think we're still not quite at the point where women can play all of the interesting roles that men can play. I mean, certainly there's still a lot of... I'm trying to think of the right way to say it, but you know, there older actresses have difficulty finding the full range of roles that older actors do. So that's a barrier in kind of our current movie system, our current system. You know, maybe it's a little different on the in the theater. I don't know.
It's not that different in the theater, unfortunately.
Yeah. But we're getting better. We're improving, you know. It's a gradual progression.
It's always a gradual progression, and it's always, you know, this fight over time. And like RBG said, you know, real change, enduring change happens one step at a time. Mm-hmm. So on that note, talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died almost exactly a week later, she earned her bachelor's degree, Phi Beta Kappa, at Cornell, and she was the highest ranking female in her graduating class. And she had such a fascinating history in terms of how her career shook out. Mm-hmm. I'm always kind of fascinated when I look at kind of her, I guess rap sheet isn't really the word, but
her resume.
Her resume. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. She does the things that you would have expected of women in that era, where she happens to marry a man she meets at Cornell. She marries Marty, the love of her life. Mm-hmm. And then she goes to work at a Social Security office. And then after she becomes pregnant, they demote her. And she gives birth to her daughter in 1955. And here is where things get a little interesting. She enters Harvard Law as one of 9 women in a class with 500. And the dean of Harvard Law invites all 9 of these women to dinner with his family and has each of them in turn explain why they are taking the place of a man.
That's a brilliant scene in the movie On the Basis of Sex, basically. I love that scene. Very well done.
Do you want to explain how they did it?
No, they have all of the women come in their beautiful 50s finery, and the dean asks, you know, why they should take the place of a man. And I love to see the women push back. You know, some of them just are taking the tack of keep your head down, make it through. But as I recall from the movie presentation, that Ruth does push back a little.
Mm-hmm. And I love that sort of fiery attitude that's displayed in the film. But the question is, from everything that I've read, at least, it didn't always seem like she was necessarily the person that spoke up the most, that she was always the most thoughtful person in the room, but she didn't necessarily speak up at the moment in the way that people would have expected.
Actually, if you could hold on just a minute,
sure.
I might be able to bring up. Yes, here it is. This is one of those online scripts. Yeah. Dean Griswold, yes. And Griswold says, "Esteemed colleagues, ladies, this is only the 6th year women have had the privilege to earn a Harvard Law degree. This little soiree is our way of saying welcome. Let's go around the table and each of the ladies report who you are, where you're from, and why you're occupying a place at Harvard that could have gone to a man." And so some of the women are offering explanations that they're going to support their father's business. And another woman pushes back and says, you know, she didn't want to be a teacher or a nurse. And she's told by the dean that that's not a very good reason. And Ruth offers that her husband is in the 2nd year class and that she's at Harvard to learn more about his work, so I can be a more patient and understanding wife. And one of the other women at the table laughs, and several others gasp, and the dean clearly is ticked off by that. But it's a fabulous scene, you know, because even if in real life she may not have pushed back that hard, it's lovely to see a fictionalized version of her be so brave in that moment. She was such a brave person. So, you know, why not make the fictionalized version of her brave?
No, absolutely. And I love that response. That's pretty great.
Yeah. That was a great script. I just loved that movie so much. That was one of my favorite movies the year that it came out.
Mm. And it's so incredible though where her story goes from there. Because, you know, her husband takes this job in New York, so she has to transfer from Harvard to Columbia. And she's the first woman on both the Columbia Law Review and the Harvard Law Review. Mm-hmm. And then she earns her law degree in 1959, and she ties for first in her class. And then in 1960, she's rejected from potential clerkships due to her gender, in spite of strong recommendations from the man who would become dean at Harvard Law. Mm-hmm. And then there was some implication in what I read that Marty may have threatened on her behalf. One of her former professors actually went to one of the clerks and said he'd never recommend someone to him again unless he accepted her as his clerk and hired her full time.
Marty really was her biggest champion. I mean, I think that comes out so clearly in the RBG documentary where it shows how he was promoting her. He was pressing the flesh. He was having meetings to get her into contention for a Supreme Court seat. And, you know, obviously succeeded.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful partnership. I also love at the end of that movie, I think it's the end of that movie where it has this little thank you section and it says, you know, to the Marty Ginsburg Wonderful Husband Award, something like that, where they're thanking the supportive men in their lives. The filmmakers.
Oh,
are.
That's wonderful.
Really sweet.
I definitely did not notice that any of the four times I watched
it. I have a habit of watching to the end of the credits on almost every film. Usually it's to look at the music, but you know, sometimes I see something amusing about in the credits, in the thank yous, or where the film is shot. So I have to say, again, I'm going on a tangent here, but it annoys some of my movie-going friends no end to need to sit through the credits or have me come out so late. But
yeah, no, I like to do that too, actually. It's just that, you know.
It's a film geek thing.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I find interesting, though, is that like James Baldwin, Ruth Bader Ginsburg kind of has to go away to kind of formulate exactly what's wrong with American society in terms of the inequities. So James Baldwin went to France and wrote as an expatriate for a number of years and was able to kind of formulate his thoughts on what was going on in terms of racism in America. And then he came back to the United States to address the issues with segregation. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, likewise, happened to go to Sweden as an associate director for the Columbia Law Group on International Procedure. And she was co-authoring a book on civil procedure with a Swedish author. So she learned Swedish. She went there. And her time there influenced her thinking on gender, where women were 25% of the law student population. And she saw female judges working 8 months into their pregnancy and being supported within mm-hmm. that society. And I think from what I read, it seems like that is where she got a lot of her ideas about what it could be.
It sounds like that was a really formative experience. And that's a really interesting parallel. I don't think that's something that would have occurred to me. In a way, when I'm thinking of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's story, I think that some of her activism might have come from a loss, a certain loss of idealism. Because, I mean, I think she was really idealistic in what she was fighting for. You know, she was fighting for all of those feminist ideas that we were talking about in that definition at the top of the hour. But I think that you also have to be a little bit naive to go and invest the money and time in a law degree if, you know, if you really were aware of the fact that you wouldn't be able to do anything with the degree when you came out. I think that there might have been a little bit of, there might have been some blinders on when she started that process.
Yeah, yeah. And a little bit of an assumption that she could make away somehow.
Right. And I mean, and eventually she did, you know, and I think, you know, one of the interviews that she does as part of the documentary RBG, which I did just see last week, she was talking about, in a way, she never would have gotten to the position that she ascended to if so many other ways had not been blocked. And so that's a really interesting perspective too, that, you know, in some ways the obstacles, you know, can, yeah, eventually help you get to a higher place if you can overcome those obstacles.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, just navigate around them in interesting and creative ways.
Yeah. So. And she certainly did. I mean, with the help of her wonderful, wonderful spouse.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, I mean, you look at all of the things that she was able to do. I mean, as the first tenured female law professor who co-authored the first casebook on sex discrimination and founded the Women's Rights Project at ACLU, and to have more than 300 discrimination cases in 2 years, six of which went to the Supreme Court between 73 and 76. And you had a hard time finding all of those cases, didn't you?
I had to do a little bit of research. I had to do a little bit of digging. So ACLU listed five of the six on their website, and the RBG documentary focused on just four of the six. But if you go to this website, Oyez, thank you. I'm obviously no lawyer. Oyez, and yes, you can find all of them. So it really was fascinating, like what her strategy was in each of these. And in particular, many of these cases were highlighting the injustices to men of living under this system that makes such distinctions between men's roles and women's roles, tries to keep each gender in its particular place.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating the way that she, you know, picked male plaintiffs to demonstrate gender inequality as such a harmful concept. And I love that she really laid the groundwork for the Equal Protection Clause in the Constitution.
The ERA, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. But actually, I mean, no, I think her work definitely builds on that. The really interesting thing that I picked up on when I was researching Women's Equality Day this year was that the first drafts of the ERA were written by Alice Paul way back in the 1920s.
Really?
Yes. Alice Paul, that great radical, was fighting for the ERA for years and years after she got the 19th Amendment, after she helped get the 19th Amendment passed. So yes, but RBG's work was definitely building the case, helping to build the case. And the other interesting thing about these cases is that she had studied Thurgood Marshall mm-hmm. and all of the cases mm-hmm. that he did to help, civil rights in the country, to help make sure that Blacks weren't treated as second-class citizens. And yeah, she was taking notes from that in all of these cases that she argued. So yeah, the ones that I looked up, I think one of the first ones was Frontiero versus Richardson, and it was about a woman who didn't get a housing allowance despite the fact that her U.S. Air Force men co-workers did get that housing allowance. And then another big case was Weinberger versus Weisenfeld, a man who wanted some benefits for being a caretaker for his son. So, and then she also argued Califano versus Goldfarb. That was 1977. That was about survivor benefits going to mm-hmm. men versus women.
Yeah. And that's the one that a lot of people talk about a lot. Like Califano comes up a lot in terms of legal precedent.
Edwards versus Healy. So that was a Louisiana law. So it was allowing women to opt out of jury service. And it was found, yes, that was definitely having an impact on the decisions. And the decisions couldn't be considered fair if women could automatically opt out. Then Duren versus Missouri. That was another jury case. And then the one out of the six that she lost, that was Kahn versus Chevin. It was about a male widower who wanted a property tax exemption in Florida. And I think that the reason that she lost that one, and I definitely could understand the reasoning on that. The justices felt that in general, men would have an easier time financially after the death of a spouse than women who lost a spouse. And I think, yes, in general, that's correct. It was a harder time. It was a harder time winning that case than it was winning some of the other ones.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's incredible. I mean, the number of lawyers that you could think of that have had six cases before the Supreme Court and had that kind of win record. Mm-hmm. I mean, you tell me, who do you know?
I mean, it sounds like an amazing record to me.
Yeah. So. And additionally, I don't know if you know this, but she actually filed the very first federal case challenging involuntary sterilization. She sued the Eugenics Board of North Carolina.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That is quite admirable. I mean, you know, we associate RBG with reproductive rights. She was such a strong proponent of reproductive rights. But I mean, that case that you just described, that seems to be more under more recent term, reproductive justice.
Exactly. Where
it's not just, you know, the right to birth control and the right to abortion and the right to sex education. It's like the right to control your own sexuality and reproduction, the right to have children. Even though I think technically that's part of reproductive rights, reproductive justice makes that idea more explicit. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Because when people think of her as being pro-choice or pro-women's bodies, they don't necessarily think about eugenics and the role that that plays as well. So, mm-hmm. And just the lack of autonomy for women over their own bodies.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen with this administration, for example, the involuntary sterilization of detainees.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen, you know, the attempt to close down any organizations that help women to gain further autonomy over their own bodies.
Right, absolutely. I mean, to the point where Planned Parenthoods under this administration cannot get federal funding. It doesn't matter whether they're offering health counseling,
cervical cancer screening, or
exactly health. Health services to men, like you say, cervical cancer screening, breast screening, you know, sex education, contraception. It doesn't matter, like, because under this administration, under any Republican administration in the modern era, you know, since Reagan, I guess, yeah, there definitely has been a quashing of reproductive rights, but this administration has been particularly brutal towards them. And the bit about forced sterilizations, or, you know, indications of forced sterilizations in detainee camps, is something straight out of Nazi Germany and eugenics. Yeah, it's just horrible. It's just horrible. But then on the other side of it is, you know, seeing women who may have been raped on their journeys to the United States to apply for asylum, and trying to restrict abortions for that group too. That's another thing that's happened under this administration. And I think they're both horrifying. I mean, yeah, I'm getting like less and less articulate because
it's okay. It's a more and more emotional issue as you talk about it, because it is deeply upsetting to me that there is no real respect for women and women's bodies.
Right. Or just this idea of reproductive justice, not a respect for people's right to make their own decisions about their own bodies, about their own sexuality, about, you know, the ability to have children or not have children. It's very troubling to see policies that restrict that. I am more concerned about life after birth. I mean, I am much more in line with the policy of let's make abortion safe, legal, and rare. I would like to bring down the number of abortions overall in the country, right? I mean, I think it would be better to have sex education and better for people to know their rights and believe they have a right to bodily autonomy and not feel forced into sex. It would be better to have access to contraception and have it be no cost. You know, I can't imagine what things are going to be like if the ACA goes away.
Yeah,
for instance, either. which is another thing that the Republicans want to do. They want to overturn the Affordable Care Act, and they don't have anything to replace it with. And of course, you know, a big item in that was making birth control free in most cases. Mm-hmm. There were exceptions carved out for religious institutions, but. Just to repeat the point, I really think that we should all be supporting a system, a healthcare system, where abortion is safe and legal, because it's to everyone's benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the elephant in the room, which is what RBG's final wishes were upon her death, which were that no Supreme Court justice be named until after the presidential election.
Mm. Of course, it's painful to think about that final wish and how it's not being honored. But I think she knew that there was no law, there was no reason that it was going to be honored just because she felt that way. I mean, I think that the stronger arguments against rushing to appoint her replacement relate to the fact that we're already in the election, and in past administrations, all the way back to Lincoln, presidents have decided not to force an appointment. And certainly the precedent that the Republicans set up about 4 years ago when Obama nominated Merrick Garland, and the argument at that point was that here we are the year before the election and there's no way that an appointment should happen. And that set a precedent to make that argument, and to see that precedent not respected, to see Republicans make a 180 on that issue is very upsetting. It makes them look like huge hypocrites. They are in fact huge hypocrites for doing a 180 on that.
Yeah. But then additionally, it made the news of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing so politically charged that it's been hard, really, to kind of process her life and to, this whole situation with replacement appointment, with everything that's happening leading up to the election, everything feels so cataclysmic right now.
Mm. Yeah, huge stakes. And I think, whether you're on the left or the right of the spectrum, the Supreme Court appointment is weighs largely in your mind. For people who really want to see reproductive rights and reproductive justice in this country, we need someone in the vein of RBG. We don't need someone straight out of The Handmaid's Tale who's happily going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And then if you're on the right of the spectrum, and let's say you're an evangelical Christian who is staunchly anti-abortion and believes that you ought to impose your own religious beliefs on the entire rest of the country, whether they're Jewish or Muslim or agnostic, then it's really important to get a justice in who will overturn Roe v. Wade. It's really high stakes on both sides.
Yeah. However, I would like to see people on the right standing up to the administration's choices regarding forced sterilization. But, when you think about Justice Bader Ginsburg's work on the Supreme Court, what do you think of her immense popularity in later life?
I think she really enjoyed it. I'm glad to see someone like her become an icon for younger women. And all of her work and everything that she represented, I'm glad to see that held up as a model for, the younger generations. I also like that she was a complicated person. When you watch RBG, when you watch On the Basis of Sex, you see that she wasn't a typical American hero, in that, you think of people who we lionize as being extroverts and tall and beautiful and, just a certain kind of personality. And she was very small and quiet and, not the typical hero. I love that she was an icon. She's always going to be one of my favorite Americans.
Mine too. And it was so special to me being able to see her lying in state at the Supreme Court. Um, I I braved possibly getting the coronavirus to go and see her in Washington, D.C. And the atmosphere there was very special. Mm-hmm. To be able to actually pay tribute to her. It was something where my mom had to bodily drag me. Mm-hmm. I did not myself want to go because I was just so concerned about the virus situation. And then when we got there, there was a suspicious package. And so they shut down one entrance and it ended up taking us like 3 hours to get into the viewing station.
That sounds so scary. I didn't hear that part of that story.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was just a lot. And nonetheless, once we were there in the presence of the Supreme Court steps and I could see the American flag over her casket, like it clicked for me, like what a momentous moment in American history had happened. And, you know, also the fact that she's the first woman to lie in state at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. I mean, that in 2020, that still blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, she was tiny in stature, but quite cast a long shadow, cast a huge shadow. That's wonderful that you were able to be there. So cool.
Yeah. And, you know, I really feel like her legacy is one that needs to be picked up by so many women now who are looking at different ways of being female and different ways of advocating for women's rights. Mm-hmm. And whatever happens in November, I'm really hoping for the best.
Yeah. I think she's such a role model for me too, because she was such a fighter. I mean, the way she maneuvered around or overcame all those obstacles, but also in her personal history, you know, the recurrent bouts of cancer, I mean, colorectal cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, and just for her to push past it, not miss a day on the bench through years and years of those illnesses, keep training with her trainer.
Yeah.
I still remember the episode that Stephen Colbert did where he was trying to keep up with her. And yeah, that was pretty amazing how strong she was, how physically strong she was, and how morally strong she was. So yeah, she's a real role model on so many fronts.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to pay tribute to these two amazing women and for being the wonderful, amazing woman that you are too, as such a passionate advocate for film, for women, for feminism.
Thank you so much for having me, Ariel. It is such an honor to be on your podcast. And I can't tell you how much I love the work that you're doing here and all of the different perspectives that you bring together. It's always entertaining when I listen to episodes, but you do bring so much scholarship to it. And I love that too. So thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, Zoya. Thank you so much.